Good morning, everyone. Good morning, George.
Morning, Tisha.
Welcome to 99% Effective. We have a great episode for everyone today. So, George, how's the lawn coming?
It has seen better days. when we get these like intense periods of rain, I'm out there, I feel like every 3 or 4 days, and you know, some days it looks really good. Some days it could use a little bit more TLC.
But yeah, I was kind of teasing you last time about it. And now I've seen like some videos of like wives just totally making fun of their husbands. They're like, okay, let me go and pretend, you know, say to my husband, oh my God, the lawn looks great. And I really don't see a difference, but I just want to give him a boost. And that's so me and my husband.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we all appreciate when the lawn looks really good and it's finally even. So, you know, you don't feel like you're walking through foot long blades of grass. So I appreciate that. And I'm sure he would too.
Yeah, he would. No, the lawns look great. I love this time of year when it's after Memorial Day and the days are getting longer and you hear the kids outside more and you hear people mowing their lawns. It's just a great time of year.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll be able to squeeze in some beach trips. You know, we've got some good weather coming up, yeah. So I'm looking forward to a really fun summer.
Well, I'm hoping this summer, the past 2 summers weather-wise hasn't been great, so I'm hoping this summer, you know, so far we had a great Memorial Day weekend, knock on wood, so hopefully we have a great summer weather-wise.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know our episode today, I think it's perfectly timed because when the summer comes, I think kind of all of our discipline goes out of the window as soon as it gets nice. So hopefully, you know, our guest today can give me some really good tips on, you know, how to keep right. that in check for sure.
Right. Everyone wants like looking their best and feeling their best, but it's hard with all the picnics and, you know, all the different foods and stuff. So I think this is great timing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So
joining us today is Kara Paknuk. She is a nutritionist and an owner of Nourish and Nosh. I love that name.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we have your website. Of course, I did my homework and I may be calling you personally, but we're going to get right into it because we have a lot of questions for you and I think will be really helpful to families.
Wonderful.
Awesome. Awesome. So Kara, can you tell us a little bit kind of about yourself and kind of what led to your current career for people who don't necessarily know what a nutritionist is?
Yes, I've always been interested in science from, you know, the early age. Science was always my favorite class in school. And when I went to college, I went to Wheaton College in Massachusetts, I majored in neuroscience. And so that was the area that I focused on. And I took a nutrition class while in college and it kind of, you know, was sort of the first step into the field. My background for summers, you know, in high school and college was actually working at a farm. So the connection between working at a farm, seeing the farmers, talking to the farmers, handling the produce, talking to the people who are buying the produce, and then my interest in science, taking the class in nutrition, it all kind of led me to wanting to pursue further degree in this. Now, with the neuroscience background, I did work with children with developmental disabilities for a number of years. And really what propelled me to actually make the leap to go back to school and apply to different universities was that I felt there was a disconnect between the children that I was working with and nutrition. So I had just a little bit of education. One class in college, so by no means was I an expert, but I had right. this drive of curiosity. Like there has to be more to this. Again, these were young children, mostly diagnosed with autism, and seeing the foods that they were eating, seeing their behaviors, and knowing that there has to be a link there. So after about 2.5 years, I enrolled at the University of Bridgeport here in Connecticut in their Nutrition Institute and completed their master's degree in nutrition. And what's ironic is I'd been in school for maybe like 2 months and they did a autism, ADHD, and allergy presentation. And I begged the school to let me attend it. And they were like, you've been in graduate school for a month. Everything's going to be over your head. I said, I don't care. I'm very interested in this. It was entirely over my head. But like now I refer back to those notes. I'm like, well, now I get it. at the time, it was definitely eye-opening.
Yeah.
So really, the path leading into it was a mix of loving science, loving food, but then also having that curiosity of how does the food we eat affect our behavior? How does it affect us medically? And really wanting to understand that link and become an expert in that field.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I think as you kind of were talking about kind of what led you to kind of getting into this field, it's very interesting because I think more and more we hear about the things that we're putting into our body and how that impacts us. And I think for those of us who work with those who may have differing abilities or mm-hmm. have an intellectual or developmental disability, we're always kind of thinking about how is the things that someone's putting into their body impacting them, right? How is today different from yesterday? And you talked about kind of working with children and that being kind of the spark. In your practice, do you kind of work with a wide range of individuals or do you have kind of a specialty as far as age group that you work with?
That's a great question. So the business that I own, I started in September of 2019. And I was coming from the weight loss area of nutrition. Okay. I had worked for a physician for a number of years. And then moving up here, you know, the focus was weight loss. And when I decided to go off on my own, I felt a very strong urge to make the name of my business something that had a positive connotation so that it would allow me to then work with other age groups. So Nourish and Nosh Nutrition has, well, one, I clearly like alliteration. It has that positive connotation that if we nourish our body, you know, it's not about depleting our body of things, it's about nourishing our body. And I had people tell me it was a bad idea to not put the word weight loss in my business name. And I'm like, no, because I want to have my doors open to other age groups. You know, mm-hmm. as a mom, you're not going to bring your 13-year-old daughter who has no idea about nutrition and is feeling, you know, awful and has digestive issues mm-hmm. to a place with weight loss in the name. That's not, from a mother's perspective, it's like, I would never do that. So if I make my business positive, I can attract, you know, obviously I'm dealing with adults who are dealing with different digestive issues, autoimmune mm-hmm. issues, very specific ailments. But then I also wanted to have that ability to work with a younger population for various reasons, whether it be a food allergy, I do a lot of that, or, you know, just teaching these kids how to eat, you know, how to put combinations of food together so that they feel really good in 2 hours instead of wanting to take a nap. So my age range that I can work with probably, I would say, spans from sort of that 11, 12, 13 being the, you know, around the youngest all the way through elderly patients. So mm-hmm. it's, I really wanted when I started this practice to make it a safe space for everyone as opposed to putting myself in some niche. My master's degree is in nutrition. And I'm not, you know, I'm not so focused on just weight loss. And a lot of nutritionists do that. So I wanted to be able to open it up to other avenues.
I have a question just to follow up with what you just said. So your age range is like 11-ish is the youngest. Now, if somebody reaches out to you and they have younger children, do you refer them to somebody else or?
It totally depends. I will say I don't do like birth to three. Like there's mm-hmm. that failure to thrive. Like that is not my area of expertise. And I would never pretend to have it be mm-hmm. my area. But if someone's coming to me with a younger child, if it's like a food allergy, mm-hmm. I do a lot with food allergies, mm-hmm. that's fine. Like teaching, because in that case, it's more working with the parents mm-hmm. and supporting mm-hmm. the parents to help them with their child. That's something, I mean, I have done younger for food allergies. That's no problem. Or if it's a specific, you know, I hate to say it, but I have seen some obese mm-hmm. children under the age of 10. And again, it's more working with the caregiver. The kids sometimes are like not even part of that conversation.
Right.
It's more to help educate the parents on ways to foster a positive relationship with food with their child, but then also to, again, tweak some of those combinations of food so that the child isn't getting too much of one thing and not enough of another. So when I have the younger kids, oftentimes it's me working with mom and dad or the caregiver.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked about, you know, your focus isn't on weight loss, you know, your focus is on the positive aspects, you know, our relationship with food. So as a nutritionist, are there typically areas that you work with your clients on when it comes to nutrition? Because I think we hear nutrition and we might think, okay, well, that means the food I'm putting into my body, but like, what does that really mean for people?
Yeah, that's a great question. you know, I get asked that a lot by like a new person. They'll be like, are you going to make me count calories? And I'm like, absolutely not. Like, that's a hard no. So the best way to explain it is, having gone to the University of Bridgeport, the program there is very much a functional nutrition based program. I, as a nutritionist, I don't know calories. We didn't study that. We didn't learn that. What I'm really good at is helping to teach people about blood sugar stabilization, whether they're a child or someone in, you know, their 80s, it affects all of us, not just diabetics. From a teaching perspective, if I'm going to tell someone, okay, you know, here's how I want you eating based on your, you know, whatever you have going on, your schedule, I'm going to tell you the why. I want you eating more protein in the morning because of A, B, and C. And I'm very big on the education. So, you know, the things I cover a lot of like understanding what the macronutrients are. What does that mean to us? You know, we hear the words protein, we hear the words carbohydrates and fat, but what does that actually mean? What does that look like on our plate? What does that look like on our shopping list? What does that look like in a recipe? Giving each person I work with the tools so that they can make decisions at a wedding, at a potluck dinner, at a barbecue. They can go into these social situations knowing, okay, you know, Kara wants me to eat protein first. Where's my protein? And we've already discussed, you know, what is a protein? And what's interesting is it was a good exercise for me as a nutritionist, having worked at Sarah, and I taught a 12-week program at Sarah twice. And it was a really great exercise in going through some of the basics of nutrition, as I did with your population. And I would tie that into almost like every week, I would like tie that into my weekly appointments with my clients. Like, hey, I know you probably know, but I'm going to actually like give you some of the basics of what a protein is. And taking a lot of what I was doing at Sarah and applying that to my own practice was actually really helpful. And I think a lot of my clients appreciated that. Sometimes we assume too much. So I really like to kind of start from scratch and explain a lot of basics. I've even had physicians in my office say to me, don't treat me like a doctor, treat me like I know nothing about nutrition. And, you know, so I really try to focus on the why. Why is hydration important? Why is fiber important? Why should I care about this? So that it sticks up here, so that in 10 years, they can pull that information out if they need to. If they're, you know, taking care of someone, it's like those concepts still apply. If you become a parent, the concept of balancing blood sugar still applies to your tiny human. You know when their blood sugar drops. Uh-huh. You see the irritability, you see the, you see it very clear. And you see it maybe in your elderly mother. She starts to become confused. Maybe she's dehydrated. Maybe her blood sugar is low. So a lot of these things I'm teaching apply to different aspects of our life.
I mean, just the information you're giving us so far is so helpful.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned kind of working with the individuals at Sarah Inc. and how, you know, you've had some exposure, but it's not necessarily kind of your mainstay. What are some of the things that as parents may be looking to figure out ways to best kind of integrate more nutritious food? You know, how did you kind of introduce that topic for the individuals that you were working with at Sarah?
That's a great question too. The biggest roadblock in that, and I saw this when I was working. Not that I was doing any counseling, obviously I hadn't had the degree yet, but I did notice there were a lot of roadblocks, whether it be sensory, whether it be a food allergy, or just preference, like a strong preference for a specific thing. And as I'm sitting in a lecture 4 weeks into my graduate program, certain recommendations they were taking or recommending, I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, I knew clients that would never go for some of this stuff. Now, you know, a decade and a little bit more later, I think there's a lot of ways to be creative, and there's a lot of ways to get nutrition in a creative way to not like cause either a behavior issue or even, in certain cases, you have to be very creative if they have sensory issues or texture issues with food. Sure. That was something that was probably the most eye-opening while working at Sarah, were the food texture issues and the sensory issues. And ways to work around that. But it takes a little, you know, thinking outside the box. And if someone can take a liquid, what else can we put in this smoothie that is going to blend, that is going to be masked by another flavor, that's going to get them some good nutrition, you know, into their diet?
Yeah.
you know, that was definitely the most eye-opening working at Sarah was the texture and sensory issues that some of the clients had. But, you know, as a nutritionist, I mean, I deal with picky eaters in totally typical adults. Like, you always have to kind of think like, okay, like, you're not going to do this. All right. Like, let's find another way. That'd probably be the hardest part about being a nutritionist is that level of creativity to work around whatever roadblock there is with an individual.
When my son was younger, he's on the spectrum, sensory, a lot of sensory, and he still has sensory issues as a young adult. The stress I had over him eating was between the eating and not sleeping. And now that I know, and I've done more research, because he's 23 now, so it really wasn't in the forefront about the nutrition as it is now, I feel. Now I know the connection. But at that point, when I say stressed, I would just let him eat whatever he wanted to eat to make sure he was getting something. And I'm sure some parents can relate to this, where I would like, okay, he's totally into the frozen waffles right now. So I would go out, buy a whole bunch of waffles. And guess what? The next day, he was not into that anymore.
Yes. Or it's a specific brand and you buy the other brand and like, you're never going to touch it. Yeah, I mean, that. It's funny you say frozen waffles. Frozen waffles, when I, at my job before becoming a nutritionist, that was a big thing, brand specific frozen waffles. Yeah. And like when I take this class and they're like, you know, they're giving all these recommendations. I'm like, if an individual is not going to have a non-brand name frozen waffle, like that's a hard no. Like how are we going to get them to eat? Mm-hmm. I can't even remember what it was, but it's, there's definitely challenges there. But like you said, we didn't know much, even like a decade ago.
Big difference now. Absolutely.
Huge difference. And the thing too, with specifically with autism that I found to be most interesting is a lot of the recommendations now are often recommendations for people who have like autoimmune disorders. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of overlap. And when it comes, what it really boils down to is inflammation. You know, these kids for so long were taking in foods that were causing such high levels of inflammation in their body. And if they can't communicate how they're feeling, it's going to manifest in behavior issues or digestive issues, not sleeping, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I deal with this a lot, even just in typical adults, of what foods should you be taking in to help decrease, and potentially what food should we be avoiding because we know they are causing this inflammation. That was something when I was, before becoming a nutritionist, I used to always think to myself, like, this kid has a lot of mucus production. He's earning milk as a reward. When he drinks the milk, the mucus is increasing. How is no one making this connection? Mm-hmm. I had not, again, that one little semester of nutrition. I'm like, dairy can cause increase in mucus production. Why is nobody paying attention to this? But again, I didn't have the degree. I didn't have the education. I just had the curiosity. And I know now dairy increases mucus production. That individual most likely had a dairy allergy, but it was never being addressed. And again, this was over a decade ago where we knew a little bit, but the parents who were trying some of these interventions, there weren't a lot of them, you know, and they weren't getting a ton of support. There weren't nutritionists specializing in it. There weren't nutritionists who really wanted to even go there because it just seemed too complicated and the parents are stressed out. I mean, my heart breaks for you having gone through that at that time, but it is. I mean, we know so much more now than we did even just 5 years ago.
Absolutely. And it's still confusing, you know, for parents because if you and everyone's Googling, you know, it's all the first thing we do, I think even before parents reach out to their pediatrician, which they should do is reach out to their pediatrician. It just has me thinking, you know, you think about there's a gluten-free diet, there's a low FODMAP diet there, you know, it's so many things we never heard of years ago. Can you tell us what's the difference? Because you hear about this a lot, I think, with the IDD community, autism community, the gluten-free diet and a casein-free diet. What's the difference?
So oftentimes they are grouped together. Mm-hmm. You may see that like gluten-free, casein-free diet. It depends entirely on the individual. So think of it in two different things. Gluten is a protein found in wheat, okay? The amount of gluten, I'm not going to give a year on this because I don't know, but in our generation, the amount of gluten in our food has increased. Part of it is how it's growing. Mm-hmm. Part of it is processed foods and the ingredients in the processed foods. the amount that we're taking in is much higher now than it was, let's say, 50 years ago.
Okay? It was. I've read a book about this.
And it's not that it's a bad thing. Gluten is fine for a lot of people. However, being a protein, it can be very disruptive for certain people outside of even just celiac. Celiac is an allergy to gluten. There's diagnosed celiac, and you get that testing and blood work. You know, you go to an allergist, you go to your doctor, you get tested for that. There's sensitivity. So there's people who may not have a severe reaction to gluten, but they just don't feel well. They're not going to the bathroom regularly. Their joints hurt a little bit. It's not so clear. And it looks different in many, you know, in many people. It could be a skin thing. It could be a gut thing. It could be a joint thing. Those three things have in common: inflammation. So a gluten-free diet is a diet that has that protein removed. Now, I say this all the time to people, a gluten-free Twinkie is still a Twinkie. A gluten-free diet does not necessarily mean it's a healthy way of eating.
Again, I love that.
With someone with celiac, if they have gluten, it could be serious. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the top, you know, big eight allergies. So for in terms of labeling, they are making products the way they normally have and then the gluten-free version mm-hmm. of it. That has no indicator of the nutrition content of that food product. So when I'm working with people who are gluten-free, it's not that we're trying to pump them full of gluten-free products. It's, well, how can we live our life avoiding wheat? You know, so there's ways around it. It's focusing on the foods that gluten never was in. Gluten has no business right. being in certain foods. So we focus more on those. Now, casein's a protein found in milk. So we've got the wheat over here and then the dairy over here. Again, where they are often put together is that it is known that many individuals, not all, when they take in dairy or they take in gluten, it causes an inflammatory response in their body. So this is different than I'm lactose intolerant. Being casein-free means, again, you may not be having a severe reaction, but you might not feel well. You might have a headache. It might be triggering like a migraine. It might be triggering some joint pain similar to gluten. They both can manifest in so many different ways. From a digestive standpoint, you know, and this is very common in the autism community, they're now doing more testing to see how inflamed the gut is. Because when the gut is inflamed, that is triggering behavioral issues. It can be triggering seizures. It can be triggering vomiting after meals. I mean, it can be triggering so many different things. So they are now finally doing more testing of the gut to see, is the gut strong, tight, or is it inflamed and loose? That's where you get the term leaky mm-hmm. gut. Things are actually leaking out because it's so inflamed. So instead of just treating the symptoms, you know, if a child has frequent diarrhea, instead of giving them a pill to stop that mm-hmm. or, you know, giving them the things to treat the symptoms, what is going on with the gut? Why is their gut so inflamed? And one of the easiest things parents and caregivers can do is to then transition to, no, I always recommend not doing two things at once, because if one is fine, you don't want to limit too much. So I always say start with one, and it's not even, I mean, you could go as far as calling it an elimination diet.
Right.
But really it's just, it would be an elimination diet and do it. I mean, doctors will, or allergists sometimes will give you different ranges. I usually say aim for 3 weeks to a month. Longer would be better, but usually, you know, pretty quick once it's cleared from the system, if this was one of the reasons why this individual is having some issues, if we see some of those issues clearing up and then transitioning to maybe the casein-free and see, you know, and sort of mm-hmm. like an experiment, a little bit of trial and error. The other thing to keep in mind, every single individual is going to be different. I mean, I say this in my practice all the time. And certainly because I work with different age groups, it's like what works for one person is not going to work for the other. We're all biochemically different. And so I don't try to do too much with someone at once, because you really want to determine what is causing the issue here. And we all, in theory, should be able to tolerate everything. if you remove something, then maybe at some point you can slowly reintroduce it and not have a problem because you've healed the gut. The goal is never to avoid, so unless it's celiac, obviously if it's celiac,
right.
You know, that's different. But these sensitivities, the goal is really to remove it, let the gut calm down, let the gut heal, and then work on maybe adding certain things in small amounts and seeing the reaction in the individual. Obviously, if someone's nonverbal, that's always a challenge, but you can usually pick up on cues, whether it be physical cues, digestive cues, and even like behavioral cues as well.
I know there's a test to see if somebody has celiac disease and has an actual allergy to gluten. Is there a test to see if somebody has a gluten sensitivity?
It's hard to tell because sometimes the antibodies will be a little off, mm-hmm. So there's so many different variables because how much gluten the individual was taking in prior to testing is because the antibodies change if the food was present. So that's really hard to pinpoint. So mm-hmm. in terms of like diagnosing a sensitivity, it's almost like it doesn't really get diagnosed the way an allergy does. You may go to an allergist, say you go to an allergist and you know how they do this in kids and adults, like the whole like arm thing. And
yeah.
Some might show a little bit of swelling. Again, a lot of it depends on like what's going on in the body at that moment the testing occurs. So it's
that makes sense.
It's really, really hard to, I don't even know if they even use the word like diagnose the sensitivity. What I have found in my practice, and this has been since day one of becoming a nutritionist, is good old fashioned trial and error. If mm-hmm. you remove something for a little bit and then add it in, is there a reaction? Or having people like document what they're eating, document symptoms, and start looking for links. It's time consuming. It's a lot of data collection, but sometimes that's the easiest way to determine if there's a sensitivity because the testing is just not accurate and, you know, can get really pricey if you like continuously start doing all these testing.
Right, you right. know? So, yes. And then I know George has some other questions, but I have one more regarding the sensory integration with the textures. Because, you know, it could be hard to get, you know, I remember my son, he was little, and I made some soup or something, and he came up to me, and he opened his mouth. He was still nonverbal at this time, so I was all excited, and I put a little bit on his tongue. You would think I just put like Tabasco sauce on his tongue and he was just like gagging and it was only sitting on his tongue. Do you have any suggestions for parents or caregivers or individuals of how to try something, how to get them to even try something of a different texture?
So a lot of it is exposure in small amounts and spacing mm-hmm. it out. So I've actually done, you know, even with adults, typical adults who just have like texture issues, you know, there kind of comes a point where it's like part of the reason why the texture is so unfavorable is a lack of exposure. So with young kids in particular, and they teach you this when you have really little kids and you're introducing food, is to introduce a variety with different textures. Even if they gag and spit it out, you've introduced it. So when we take in something and immediately reject it, oftentimes it's the body's way of saying like, no, this is not safe. It's slowly, and I know, listen, I'm a parent. I know this is so hard. I know this is so hard. Like I struggle with this with my daughter. Like,
yeah,
it's just being persistent and small, tiny amounts, whether it be a flavor thing or a texture thing,
mm-hmm.
just small, tiny amounts. The other thing too that I tell people, even before we get to the eating part, totally forgot to mention this, I'll have a client hold the food, like touch it, mm-hmm. so they touch mm-hmm. it with their hands, smelling the food, and like we stop there. So I've actually done things with, I should have mentioned this, I've done things actually with individuals in the supermarket. I work next to a grocery store, and I've taken, this was a younger client, through the store, and we just touched things. We had masks on. There was no smelling at this time, but we just went through the store touching different foods, different vegetables. We obviously cleaned our hands, but like yeah. vegetables, fruits, just to get a feel for it, because it was such a foreign, the concept was so foreign, and we were trying to have a little bit of a breakthrough. And so the first step was literally touching. Just touching before we even got to the eating. Smelling would be a great step. So really hitting all the senses before we touch. So one of the things, one of the bits of advice I give to a lot of my clients is to get their children or anyone, and this was actually a great thing we did at Sarah, was getting them involved in the making of things. Touching, we had individuals scooping things, touching, probably a little bit less touching, again, you know, sanitation and stuff. But we did our best with having them handle the food safely before it was even prepared, or having them smell it, even just seeing it, smelling it, feeling it all before tasting it can kind of help ease the system into recognizing the food as something safe versus something that needs to be rejected. It takes so much. It takes so much time. I do realize that. And it's hard. I mean, it's hard for parents. Like George, you can probably relate too. It's like,
I was thinking about that. And, you know, as we talk about the textures or certain food aversions, you know, and a lot of it is the exposure to certain foods. And I think that parents, whether you have a neurotypical child or not, you always think, okay, what's going to be the easiest? Because there's so many things going on in the day, and you kind of revert to, well, if I can get something into their body, it's better than nothing, right? And I think from our conversations, what I'm hearing, and we've kind of touched on this earlier, it's how do you develop those healthy eating habits of, yes, I absolutely want to get something into my child, and absolutely not everything is going to be quote unquote considered healthy foods. Oh, and let's not talk about pseudo healthy foods. Something is diet versus regular, and you know, the ways of kind of tricking people to thinking foods are healthy. And I remember when we were kind of working on the program at Sarah, we talked about creating healthy eating habits. How do you go through a grocery store? You know, and so as you're talking about navigating through a grocery store, I think that having someone experience a food, whether they can touch it or see it, certainly alleviate some of that unknown that comes with it. Are there things that you work with your clients specifically on how to develop healthy eating habits based on kind of the foods that they say they like or don't like?
A lot of it, again, stems from that education. So informing the individual of the why. Why are we doing this? Like I sent an email out this week kind of talking about this again, and it comes up all the time. Why should we care about the food we're putting into our body? Well, longevity is always a big one. Increasing energy, and this goes out, this is outside of if they have a specific, they have diverticulitis, why should they care about the food they're eating? Well, they're trying to heal an infection and heal pain that they have. So right. Even like before we get to that, it's like, well, we want to feel our best. We want to have stable energy throughout the day. We don't want to be falling asleep at our desk. We don't want to be cranky in the afternoon. We don't want to lose patience with our kids because we haven't had anything to eat in 7 hours. So the why is very important in terms of motivating someone to make these changes. And the thing is with nutrition, we always, you know, like you said, like we think what's easy. And what's shocking is we're putting more time into other things. And then when it comes to actually feeding ourselves, we're looking for the quickest shortcut. It's like, well, actually, right. Let's reframe this, because if we take a little bit more time with the food and making those choices or creating systems in our home so that it is quick, but we've put these systems in place where we know where our food is, we've done a little bit of planning, not overwhelming, but we know what we're having maybe ahead of time. If we put those systems into place, it's easier and quicker to execute the good choices, but understanding the why. Well, if I take a break and have a quick snack, my blood sugar is not going to be crashing by lunchtime when I didn't bring a lunch. So now I'm ordering, you know, quick takeout, and the choices aren't going to be the greatest because I'm starving. Whereas taking right. a 5-minute break to have a snack, even if you need to order lunch out, you're in a much better place physiologically to make a choice that's going to feel a little bit better because your blood sugar is not tanking. A lot of our behaviors are often tied to those spikes and drops in blood sugar. In terms of teaching people healthy habits, understanding the why is always number one. But then number two is, okay, if I give you the tools, how are we going to execute them at home? How are we going to execute them at work? And that's where I've gotten really into teaching people about different systems that work for them. So organization is huge. We can have all the best intentions. We can have a fridge full of beautiful, beautiful produce, but if nothing's washed, we can't see what's behind any of it because we did all of our shopping in one day and it's like crammed. you're not going to be inspired to actually eat it because you're like, I don't want to wash these things. I can't find, like, I think I bought hummus, but like, did I though? I can't see it. And so I take a very much a like divide and conquer, take it 2 days at a time approach so that people aren't overwhelming their fridge, losing sight of literally what they've purchased. Then they end up throwing food away. Then they lose motivation to actually bring it to work. So I take it like literally 2 to 3 days at a time. And it's like, you got this. Like, you went to the store, you have a list for 2 to 3 days. We don't need to be thinking about the end of the week right now. Like, that is too far in advance. You make enough decisions during the day. Forget the end of the week. Let's focus on the beginning of the week. Where is your food? Is it prepped? You know, while you're doing one thing, can you also be prepping something else? Multitasking, I know you're not supposed to do it, but like, I'm big on multitasking. And especially like, you know, with parents and with anyone with younger individuals at home or people who they're caregiving for, getting them involved. This is where you can add in that sensory integration. Mm-hmm. Hey, can you wash these grapes? Can you pick them off of the thing and wash them? Can you, if someone's comfortable with a knife, can you trim this celery? You know, whatever it is, and you're getting them involved. I mean, even, I remember this when my daughter was little, I would puree food for her. I made all her baby food. I know it wasn't that hard. I mean, I did it while I was doing other things, but I would let her play with it. I would let her touch the food. If she was making a mess, it didn't matter. She was smelling it. She was smearing it on her face. Like, it was all for that sense. It turned into a sensory project. You know, like parents do sensory work with their kids. Like, I did a lot of food sensory stuff with her to get that hand, mouth, smell, getting everything tested with it. But I was doing that while prepping other things, obviously, you know, keeping an eye on her. But there's ways to create space and time to build in these practices, these systems, so that you can have 2 or 3 days of, you know, what you're having for breakfast. Your snacks are prepared for work. You may have one dinner prepared, but you've got protein in the fridge for another dinner to help these habits become habits. And so that it doesn't become something that you then resent. You know, I tell everyone I work with, like, I'm not putting you on a diet. Diet is what you're eating. That is the correct word. Your diet is the food you put into your body. But I don't put people on a specific diet. It's teaching them how to make these healthy habits stick. Well, in order for them to stick, we have to have systems in place for you that are individual to you so that you can keep the ball rolling. And it's not something that adds more stress. It just becomes something that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm curious, when you talk about kind of the nutrition piece of it and how people don't think about the word diet as that's actually the food that you're putting into your body versus the diet is the thing that I need to do to lose weight or to form a healthy habit. So I you know, I think the education piece that you talk about is really important. Of let's really talk about the words that you're using and making sure they're using them correctly so that you truly understand if my end goal is to improve my overall health, well, it's not that I need to go on a diet, it's I may need to improve my diet, which is the food that I'm intaking. Oh, and then obviously there's the other piece, right, that nobody really wants to talk about, of that balance between having a healthy lifestyle, but that's also going to require some movement, you know, and integrating some of those aspects into our lives.
Right. And the thing too is I talk about this a lot with people where I'm like, listen, I'm not an exercise expert by any stretch of the imagination, but if someone feels awful, how are they going to move their body? So I'll say to them, like, we're going to focus on food first. Get you on good, you know, balancing your blood sugar throughout the day, getting you on these good habits. And the thing about blood sugar, it's not like it takes, you know, 3 to 6 months for you to feel better. Like, it's constantly changing. So like, you feel better almost immediately. So like, let's get a few days under our belt of good balanced blood sugar, good scheduling, which then affects our sleep. We're sleeping a little bit better in theory if things are kind of even keeled throughout the day. We're not having these digestive issues. They're starting to calm down. And then we can talk about moving your body. But it's much easier to move your body when the energy increases. So I will say I do help hold people accountable, but I'm very much like, let's focus on the food first. And then I do refer out for exercise, obviously, all the time. Now with like the virtual world, it's like there's tons of stuff online that you can do for free from the privacy of your own home. But let's get you to a place where you actually feel good enough to do it again, like you said, so the habits stick long term.
I want to go back to the grocery store. You brought that up, and I know this is not, and I'm sure people have brought this up to you, eating right or healthy or better is expensive.
So that's what, yes. And especially now, right, with prices going up,
mm-hmm,
you know how I mentioned I really try to take it 2 to 3 days at a time?
Right.
I push that so much more now for the simple reason I do not want people throwing food away. I don't want them overbuying and then stuff going bad. Now, obviously during lockdown, we were all grocery shopping like once every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that was really hard. And I had to teach, you know, a lot of my methods had to change during that time. One of the things that stuck from then to now is leaning heavily on frozen vegetables, mm-hmm, and frozen fruits as well. So there, I get asked the question, like, is it just as good? And the answer is absolutely, and sometimes better depending on the produce, because they are picking it, freezing it, and then transporting it, as opposed to picking it, transporting it, and then it comes, you know, into our home. A way to save money is to not do bulk shopping, because again, you block something, you don't see it, it goes bad, mm-hmm, there's your money going right in the trash. So instead, divide and conquer, you know, break your week up into two, have a plan for, you know, the first half of the week, and then figure out the next half. And if you, like, let's say you don't eat something, well, you want to get that in, and not having the fridge overwhelmed with stuff allows you to see it, so then you're eating it and not wasting it. And then the other thing I recommend is frozen vegetables. Frozen, mm-hmm, frozen is absolutely fine. It is going to be less expensive. The other little trick I tell people to do, and I've had it, people are like, kind of odd, but like, I see where you're coming from. I'll buy those little bags of frozen veggies, cut them, and like sprinkle some of what's in it in a stir fry, and then re-put it back in the freezer. Or for like my daughter, if she wants broccoli and I'm not having broccoli, I'll cut the bag and cook some broccoli, and then save the rest for another thing. And that's a great way to elevate meals in an inexpensive way, because the frozen produce is going to be less expensive. Instead of just cooking an entire bag, I'll cut it, cook some of it,
mm-hmm,
and save the rest for later. But I'm grabbing from a bunch of different vegetables to then help diversify what I'm cooking in front of me. So yes, it is more expensive, but you have to be strategic so you're not wasting or throwing away your money. Highly palatable, highly processed snack foods are going to be less expensive, but they're providing you absolutely no nutrition. So if you put your money into food that's going to actually satiate you, actually fill you up, you're in a way, not that it's gonna be evening out, it is going to always be a little bit more expensive. I'm not saying that, but you're getting more bang for your buck.
Right.
With a food that's more nutrient dense than a bag of something that you eat the entire bag and you're still hungry.
You mentioned, and I think this is a, you know, a little bit of a plug for you and Sarah, but you talked about some, when I'm cooking for my daughter and this and that. So is there a cookbook out there that would be good for people to use?
Yes. So when I work with Sarah, I put together a cookbook with Sarah, obviously, of the meals and the snacks and the bread, like all the different things that we put together collectively. So I was, and what I love about it is it's simple. It works great for kids, to be totally honest. I mean, it really is just super, super simple recipes. One of my favorite ones, we did a shepherd's pie that the first day of class, I asked the group, like, what's one of your favorite dinners? And they all, shepherd's pie. I said, okay, didn't see that coming. I can work with this. And we made a absolutely delicious, super healthy shepherd's pie using sweet potato, ground turkey. And the vegetables were we had them pick what vegetables they wanted to put in, and they loved it. And it's actually a recipe now I give to all my clients, and they love it too. And it's just something that's super simple, super easy. If you are interested in purchasing the cookbook, you could go to Sarah's website. They have a link to it, and we'll put that in
our show notes too. Absolutely.
Yeah. It'll be in the show notes. And I think what I enjoyed most about that particular project was really the hands-on approach, Kara, that you took to it, of how do we get the most integration during probably one of the more difficult times of COVID, but still providing individuals that opportunity to feel like they're taking part in everything. So, you know, being able to prepare meals, being able to prep meals. You know, we even talked about how do you navigate the grocery store? What's the most appropriate way to navigate the grocery store? You know, where do you find the healthier item? Thinking about the outsides of the grocery store, if you will, of that's where you're going to find a lot of your natural or your organic or, you know, your vegetables and your fruits and things like that, right? Versus avoiding kind of that middle of the store where you have a lot of processed foods. And I think that's something that people don't always think about of, you know, where do you find the healthy stuff? Well, it's actually right in front of you most of the time when you walk into the grocery store. And we all run past that section. Not me, but I do love cookies. So, you know, we all run past that section to get to the things that we really enjoy. But I think the cookbook was a great opportunity to have kind of that exposure to, yes, I can eat healthy. And yes, I do enjoy eating healthy as well.
And it doesn't have to be a ton of work, and it doesn't have to be super complicated. You know, at the end of the day, the food that nourishes us the most is the food that we're preparing from scratch. And it doesn't need to be this like hour long thing to make one small meal. It actually can be quick. It can be efficient. It can be easy, but then also yield a super yummy, super nourishing. You're checking off all the boxes. You're getting your good carbs. You're getting your good fats, and you're getting your protein in a meal. I'm thinking of our delicious shepherd's pie. You know, that didn't take long. It was a really quick meal to put together. It took longer to cook than to prepare. And, you know, it was a great opportunity for them to help stir the ground turkey in the pan. It was a good opportunity to see, like, this is what the ground turkey looked like. You know, we included a lot of photos of, like, this is what it looked like in the store when I bought it before bringing it in. You know, this is where it is found in the store. So that was actually a great way to tie it all together nicely when you were cooking. Like, this is where it is in the store. This is the container it comes in. This is what it looks like when you open it. It was a really great way to teach, but then have that hands-on approach. And they really loved it. So it was really a great opportunity.
Yeah. And as we kind of come to a close today, you know, what are some things that in general you think are really important for people to know? They might say, you know, maybe I can't go to a nutritionist, but I do want to kind of start my journey to being healthier and eating healthy. You know, what are some kind of tips you can provide people?
Number one tip, and this is a number one thing, if I could rent a billboard and put it on the highway, it would say, you're all not eating enough. So what I mean by that is, eat your breakfast. Take the 10 minutes, the 5 minutes, have a good breakfast. And a good breakfast is something that's going to be protein based, whether it be eggs or a smoothie or yogurt, or it could be a spoonful of peanut butter. Getting that protein in first thing in the morning is huge. It really sets the tone for the day. Breakfast is always the thing I try to steer people to not skip. And then really look, we're all individuals. Look at your day. Try not to go 6, 7, 8 hours without eating something. A snack is designed to bridge the gap between meals. So when we don't have a snack, our blood sugar will start to drop and we're not going to feel our best when that happens. And when mealtime comes, we are starving. So then portion control goes out the window. You know, everything goes out the window because you're so hungry. So you want to try to avoid that by building in a snack earlier in the day, whether it be between breakfast and lunch or between lunch and dinner or both, depending on you as an individual, when you're waking up, when you're going to bed. I mean, always keep in mind, not everyone has the same schedule. So when I work with people, it's like, sure, when do you wake up? When do you go to bed? And let's put the pieces in accordingly based on your schedule. But I would say breakfast and snacks are the things lunch and dinner get easier to handle when you've had a good breakfast and snacks. So it's like you need to focus on that first, and then those just become easier because you've done the work in the morning and throughout the day. And always drink plenty of water. I'm big on hydration, so drink plenty of water throughout the day as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you, Kara. We really feel like, you know, this was such a great opportunity for us to kind of learn about nutrition and kind of really provide parents, you know, and people out there that really good insight on how do I take care of my body. It is the one thing that's going to propel me and allow me to kind of really be the most successful in my day. So again, I just want to thank you very much.
Kara, thank you so much. This was so helpful. I really think the families are going to get a lot of useful information from listening to this podcast. I know I did.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Awesome. Thank you, Kara. As always, you can find our podcast on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and the Starlink website. On any Amazon or Alexa-enabled devices, you can ask Alexa to play 99% Effective Sarah Solutions podcast. And let us know what you want to learn more about. If you have an idea or topic, let us know. We would love to hear from you.